You gotta try all the other milks too, because there's pea milk.
I will never drink pea milk. Can't do it. Won't do it. They got a branding problem.
They gave it a better name. You know, you don't even know it's pea milk until you look at it.
Of course you do.
Look at the
you better not know.
Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 227 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam. I'm riddled with viral infectious gook.
I'm Sam. My sweater's riddled with holes.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is October 14, 2019. Before we get started, we have a warning. We're going to have profanity. So, you know, that's the thing that's going to be happening. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a couple of messages. Mackenzie Cole says, thanks for talking about stuff.
We got you, Mackenzie.
Nice to have some smart, down-to-earth people to talk about therapy, living better, trying out being more veg subsistent. Iron supplements made it go for me, Mackenzie says, et cetera. Nice. I love Crashlands, but the podcast and getting to laugh with you all has been a true gift. Thanks.
Nice.
And also, Stefania Lintonbon says, hello, fellow podcasters, from Stefania at Positive Affirmations and Audio Stories Podcast. Mm. So we got some crossing the streams going on here.
Nice.
And we'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. All right, let's talk about the fact that 2019 has returned to seek revenge on all of us.
Yes.
In this case, a tree branch has fallen on Sam's wife's car.
Correct. So I think last week I reported that I had to replace all my tires, right? I think uh-huh. That happened. So
yes, that is correct.
If I recall. So 2019 just decided that wasn't quite enough to, you know, continue this along with the dishwasher episode from a few weeks ago. And so on Saturday morning, my wife woke up to go to kickboxing and hopped in her car and then came back in the house screaming and was like, what? Because a huge branch from a sycamore. This is not the tree, by the way, that we cut down because it was
– because it died.
Because it was dropping branches. This is a different tree entirely that is perfectly healthy. Just dropped a huge branch. Yeah. Just dropped a huge branch straight down. And so it basically fell like a – sort of like a, you know, missile or lawn dart maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Just fell straight into the bottom of her windshield, like the bottom perfectly centered. And so it just – like just sort of shattered the whole thing through. But of course, it's a windshield and the modern ones don't like shatter.
Yeah, they're filled with glue. Pieces.
Yeah. And so it's just cracked. It's
cracked, yeah.
So that happened. And it happened on Saturday morning, which was just a thing. And
it's
then,
been a weird year because it's from a business standpoint, things have been going great.
Yeah, it's coming along.
Like,
yeah.
Like Levelhead, like our production's singing along, mm-hmm. like the business is running just fine. You know, we got all these good deals in the works. Mm-hmm. Like, but yeah, but everything else
is on fire.
Seems to be chaos.
Yeah, and then her laptop broke.
Yep.
So apparently some of the older surfaces, when they get a little hot at some point, the screen like sort of somehow becomes two screens on top of each other.
This is just like our dash cams melting in the heat.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think she's played too much Roller Coaster Tycoon, and that's probably what happened. You know?
Couldn't.
Overheated on that 1996 graphics engine.
It's an intense one. Depends how big your park is. You can get a lot
she's
of stuff
She's got some
going on.
Very elaborate parks.
Yeah, so who knows what 2019 has in store next week, but I'm sure it's terrible.
God.
It'll be something.
I'm sure it's terrible.
2020 can't come fast enough, to be honest.
I guess I did have a light flickering in my house.
So
that happened to me.
Oh, yeah, also, all of our fire smoke detectors went out. And then the one in the attic went out, which we didn't even know we had.
When you say
there.
It went out, what do you mean?
They did the thing where they're like, bleep, and they just scream at you for a while, you know?
So the
and then you have
died.
To go hunt them down, but they only last long enough that you can't quite tell with your human hearing.
Yeah, and they're so high-pitched that you
painful.
Can't quite tell where they are because it just hurts too much.
Exactly.
But the batteries died for all of them?
Three of them, yeah.
On the same – during the
just
same
like
week.
Over the course of the week. And then the one in the attic, which again, we didn't even know there was one up there and has been sealed, by the way. So there's like a little tent thing. So I had to go up there at like midnight when it started beeping on Friday night and unzip this
it
tent.
It always happens at midnight.
I don't know why.
That's the time.
Climb into the attic and then, you know, stand on these 90-degree stairs that we have because it's an old house with an old attic. You know,
yep.
It was very exciting.
It's like a ladder pretending to be stairs is what you
have. Yeah, that's basically what it is. That's correct.
Okay, well, that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I've been now 10 days. I haven't eaten a single piece of meat.
That's wild for you, Seth.
I don't want to say I'm a vegetarian because I'm just – if I have the option, I'm just not eating meat. But if I, you know, If I don't have the option, then I just it's fine.
You're vegetable forward.
Yes.
You know, like many modern restaurants.
Yes.
Mm. And by many, I mean a small handful.
But it's been a fun journey because I've been basically, you know, cause if you go to the grocery store, a lot of times near the meat section, they'll then have like all of the fake meats in like a huge area. And so I've just been trying all of them. I'm kind of like creating a ranking of like, all right, because I know meat.
Have you tried?
I know my meats. This man. You know?
Have you tried the corn dogs yet?
No, I couldn't find them, but I'm going to keep looking. Mm-hmm. But I've tried burgers and sausages and like ground beef and stuff, and it's all made out of sometimes soy, sometimes wheat gluten.
A lot of beans.
Sometimes pea protein.
Pea protein, yep.
That's the new one. Yeah.
And so far they've all been good. Only one of them has tasted like meat, and that's the Beyond Meat Burger.
Yeah, that one is exactly a meat. It's a drop-in meat substitute.
Yeah, but I think just like when I started switching to drinking soy milk instead of milk, you know, the first time I did it, I was really upset because I was like, "This is garbage. This doesn't taste like milk." But then once I got over the fact that it didn't taste like milk, you can just kind of evaluate it for just what it is by itself, and it's quite good. Mm-hmm. And so then the same thing goes with all these other things. Which is, they're good. They're just good.
So, yeah, I try all the other milks too, because there's pea milk.
I will never drink pea milk. Can't do it. Won't do it. I mean, a branding problem.
They gave it a better name. You know, you don't even know it's pea milk until you look at it.
Of course you do.
Look at the
you better not know.
Although, honestly, they should have just called it pea milk, because then people would think that was hilarious.
It would be very funny.
Listen, if you are going to space, you'll probably have to drink real pea milk, because we have to recycle the, you know, the pea
and put it into some milk powder.
Yeah. Then it's that's no good.
There are some things, at least I guess from a verbal standpoint, that you just can never do. Pea milk.
Pea milk. Don't do it.
It will never be a product in the name, you know? No, soy milk, almond milk, yeah. Everyone's into it. Yeah.
Pea
milk.
Don't know how you milked that soybean, but you did.
My own personal rating from all those milks is basically, it goes the oat milk at the top. It's the most like milk. It's like it's thick and, you know, whatever. And then pea milk after that.
Can't do it.
And then soy milk after that. And then almond milk I put somewhere in the basement.
Really?
Yeah, it's just like
very watery.
It's watery, hint of almond taste.
It's got nothing going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is something I'd encourage anybody to just try this out, just because it's pretty mind expanding.
Well, it's just fun to do something different every so often.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be like, I'm a vegetarian now. No, who cares?
Just spend a week just trying out a bunch of weird, you know, meat, fake meat.
Weird
stuff.
Sausage.
Yeah.
It also helps to adhere to Michael Pollan's food rules, which are eat food, mostly plants, not too much.
I think
that's the secret to not.
Sugar's done. A plant.
Yeah, I violate all three of those rules on the regular.
I know, because that first one is. Eat food, because he goes on and elaborates all of that.
Oh, right? So sugar's not food.
Sugar's not food.
It's poison.
It's too processed from the original food source. Mm.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm having a good time with that. And I know that a lot of people are like, I switched to being a vegetarian or vegan, and like I just feel so much.
I don't feel any different.
I feel exactly. Why would you? I feel exactly the same.
You get the same caloric content.
But I feel better about knowing that nothing had to die so I could have lunch.
Yep.
You know, that's a nice.
That's kind of like –
little silver lining.
You're probably also less likely to develop diverticula in your intestine.
That's true.
So that's a nice bonus.
Nailed it.
Doesn't happen to American men like a ton more than
because
they eat so much meat.
Yeah, and also
we just
swallow it for some reason. So
we're busy.
We're basically owls.
Yeah,
you got to just throw a steak back. You just
I don't know.
Just chew it once and then you swallow it.
Now I don't know if this is true of Americans generally, or if it was just true of our specific
Midwestern
like
style. Yeah.
We had legit, we had a 22-minute lunch period in high school, and it took sometimes upwards of 15 minutes to get to the cafeteria, get in line, and get your food, which means you had to be trained to eat a whole meal and get back to your class in under 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm. To this day, like I still eat so fast. It's just dumb.
Yeah.
My wife and I went out for our 3-year anniversary on Tuesday night. We went to a fancy restaurant, eating some fancy food, and the guy would show up with the thing, and then he'd basically turn around.
And his hand was gone because you had eaten it.
Yeah, we were just like a vacuum. It was insane.
Yeah. So there's a certain sort of speed eating training that happens, at least in our part of the U.S.
I have not – even anybody else in Iowa, I've not talked to any other person from another school that had a 22-minute lunch period.
It seems insane, you know.
What do you do in Grinnell? What do you do it?
Yeah.
Get it together.
And then, Sam, you saw The Joker. Let's talk about that.
I did. I thought it was very good. It's extremely hard to watch. It's the easiest way to put it. Extremely hard to watch. Very well done. Joaquin Phoenix is ridiculous. That's the easiest way to put it.
Hard to watch like it's too bright, too like it's blinding.
No. It's everything else.
Too dark?
Too dark. Yeah, I don't need to say too much more about it.
Would you recommend?
I mean, I would recommend if you know you can stomach
it. Like if you're having too good of a day.
Yeah.
Watch some Joker. Bring yourself down. Yep.
It's a few notches. It's a lot of feelings. So just be ready if you're going to do that.
Intense.
Okay.
Very intense.
Okay. Let's talk about studio news. First thing, we did our quarterly review. We do a quarterly review, as you might guess, every quarter.
Who knew?
That's every 3 months. And so essentially it gives us – we realize that after about 3 months, things have generally flown off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like no matter
to
what –
some extent or another.
Yeah. No matter what we've managed to achieve or whatever, by the time 3 months goes by, things are getting pretty loose.
Yep.
You know?
You got to have those regular check-ins.
Yeah. Know? And so this is like a hard reset. We actually take a full day. So we don't do any development or anything else. We just take a full day and just go over the last 3 months, talk about what went wrong, what went right, changes we want to make to adjust going forward. So I think the big thing for this upcoming quarter is we're switching back to 16-hour sprints.
Yeah.
So a sprint is – it comes from agile methodology of production planning. And it's essentially – it's like you have a meeting and you plan out like the next chunk of work for a certain amount of time. And a lot of companies will do 2-week sprints. That seems to be like a really common amount of time. And so – we were originally, when we switched to DevOps, we were doing 16 hours. So it would be Tuesday morning, production meeting, and then you've got the rest of the day Tuesday, all day Wednesday, and Thursday morning. And then Thursday afternoon, you plan out the next sprint. Mm-hmm. And then that's all day Friday, all day Monday.
And the main reason for that was because we were like, we don't know what we're doing. So we need to do this. We need to do this with enough – with like sort of a tight enough time window that we can really make sure that that we're on track, basically. It's like a lot of practice, essentially.
Yeah.
And to be responsive was the main thing.
Yeah. And enough things happen in even just a couple of days that by the time you get to that production meeting, there's a lot of stuff to go over. And so, of course, if you go a week or 2 weeks, then now you've got hundreds of things to go over. And it's much more difficult to keep it all in track. And then you end up sort of like rushing through the meeting and skipping a bunch of things. And so we just kind of found – so when we switched to the weekly patch schedule for Levelhead – around early access launch, we kind of felt like it was out of sync with our production meetings. Yeah. So we switched to a weekly sprint, and we'd been doing that ever since. But as of this quarterly review, we're kind of looking back and we're like, you know, by the time the end of the sprint comes around, things are just really chaos.
Yeah.
We're interrupting each other a lot. We're like barging in, telling people that we've given them tasks when really it should be part of the process. And so
– well, a lot of it too is that there's – because basically the thing that you're trying to do with this kind of production management is get away from unplanned work.
Yes.
Right? And what we found was that unplanned work was still – basically the longer your sprint is, the more of it becomes unplanned work. Yeah. And this is going to depend – at least for us. It depends on exactly what the roles in the team are that are doing the work, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're part of a really big team, like building some like large institutional product – where plans are coming down from above about what needs to happen and the people who are doing the work don't have to respond to like administrative emails and whatever, right? Then I think you can get away with longer sprints because there's less unplanned work that can even be created. But when your production team is the same as the team running the business and the same as a team managing employees, like doing everything, then it's just much more likely that
there's too many inputs.
There's basically too many inputs, and so many of those inputs have nothing to do with actually even the product development. And there's a lot that is product development too. I think a really small team where everyone's wearing a lot of hats, I think it's a lot harder to have a longer sprint. Yes.
Yeah, so we're going to be doing that. It's going to be interesting. And I think 16-hour sprints is probably as fast as you can do it. Otherwise, you would just be doing it every day, and then it's not a great
too
way
much
to,
meeting overhead.
It's just not a good way to kick off the day. So that's happening. And then also Sam got an iPhone.
Yeah.
Adam got a Google Pixel. So we discovered that these guys have been sitting on ancient.
We've been overdue.
Ancient technology. Phone technology for years. Not upgraded your phones.
Also, my favorite thing is I walked in and I was like, hey, I could trade this in. And they looked at it because it's just like shattered up the back. Yep. And they were like, no. They're like, also, you own it, so it's fine.
Yeah, you don't need to trade it. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. It's just yours now. You paid for it.
Yeah, so well, one of the big questions we had was, can we get more of an actual on-the-ground experience with iOS, right? And a big part of it, of course, is because, you know, with Crashlands and with Levelhead, we're not exactly sure what the mobile plan is going to be. But we do want to bring it to mobile. And so a big part of it was like we actually don't have across our team any familiarity with sort of the full stack of the iTunes side of things and the iOS side of things. And so, yeah, we're chatting about it. And then with the arcade, I was like, to me, the arcade is a phone selling thing. So I was like, I literally will buy a phone.
It's like buying a console for God of War.
Yeah,
I will buy the phone. And I was just so close to getting an iPhone for that sake. Like the thing for me that broke it was the lack of a fucking headphone jack.
Yeah,
that was the thing. Yep. I was like, because I was looking at the Google Pixel, which and basically the Google Pixel and the iPhone XR are basically the same phone in terms of like all their specs and stuff. Like the difference is now like, do you want an iPhone or do you want an Android? Right, that's really the difference. And for me, I was like, I really wanted to get an iPhone because I wanted the arcade experience. Mm-hmm. But that lack of a headphone jack,
I know it's kind of wild.
I just couldn't. The courage.
Yeah, I couldn't do it.
Yeah. So there's a few of those things. But I think for the most part, the Switch has been pretty easy, honestly.
Yeah.
Like it's taken some time to kind of like migrate all my stuff over and do some of those things. But it's been pretty painless.
The interfaces are not really that much different.
No, not anymore. I think this thing's like actually early on they were.
Yeah.
But they've sort of converged in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like they've both stolen the good stuff from each other. And so it's kind of like it's a lot of the sameness.
Yeah.
It didn't take me too long to kind of get acquainted with it, despite the lack of buttons, which is the newest thing.
But it does have a mute button, which is a nice.
There's a little toggle, a little mechanical toggle. You're switch. Just like shut up, and then it's done.
I love it. Does it just mute everything? Is that what?
Yeah,
nice.
So yeah, I got the iPhone, which has been an interesting switch, and then with that, the arcade, which has been super fun.
You spent the weekend playing Apple Arcade games.
Yeah, I played Grindstone, which is this hilarious. I showed Adam and Seth before the podcast this hilarious puzzle game where you're just chopping through monsters in sort of a, you know, like a chain the colors sort of a game, but it's gratuitous cartoon fantasy violence and it is hilarious. So I've been playing that one, and then mainly I was just shocked by Oceanhorn 2, which is more or less, I mean, the main Unreal Engine, and it looks stupidly gorgeous and plays good. And they did this interesting thing where, because one of the questions I've always had with 3D games on a phone is of course how you control the camera. Or if you have to somehow make a camera so smart that it can deal with whatever the player wants to do. And so they actually have no joysticks on screen, which I thought was also fun because at this point, it's kind of like people know, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. So bottom left is where you rub your thumb to move around. And then actually in the top area, if you rub your thumb up there, then you are controlling the camera now. But with no actual on-screen controls for those two things. And
do they just have like a prompt that comes up when you first start playing and shows you?
We got nothing. And it was funny because I just poked it and I was like, okay, yeah. I mean, I guess I didn't need to be told this, to be honest. Like, as soon as you start rubbing it, things happen, right?
Yeah. If it responds, then you can figure it out.
Yeah. And so, yeah, Oceanhorn 2 is just impressive, frankly. It's a good game. It's sort of like a Zelda-esque thing.
Yeah.
And it's stupidly gorgeous. And I was like, how? What?
Do they do – I imagine with – when you're trying to get a really high-end game to work on mobile, probably what you do is you design a game like that where there's not – you get to have really beautiful scenery and so on, but there's not a lot happening at any given moment, right? So there's like not a ton of enemies on screen at once or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's like three or four enemies at once. And I think it looks like they're doing a really good job of sort of loading zones.
Yep.
It's like I've gone into the mines and then it loaded in a chunk.
Right.
But, you know, so things are different rooms and
yeah. So they're kind of batching it in that way. Yeah. But it's been very cool. So it's been a lot of fun switching over.
But you haven't played Sasquatch yet.
I have not played Sasquatch yet.
That's still the one that I want to hear about.
I mean, that's as far as I understand, that's the one that really moves the iPad.
That does. Yeah. It does.
Okay. Well, I'd like to hear more as you get to poke around more.
And yeah.
Goose Game is in there too, right?
Is it?
I think it is.
Yeah, I think it is.
I'm not 100% sure. Okay. Perfect.
I'd be curious to know how that handles with touch controls and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
It was the case when I got home with my new Android device, which actually I like it a lot more than my old Samsung because it feels – it's much more of a Google – I mean, it's a Google device, right? And so everything feels a hell of a lot tighter and less bloaty, because also Samsung packs their phones full with all kinds of just, frankly garbage shit. Apps.
Yeah.
None of it is any good.
All sorts of weird.
It's really bad.
And they want you to use them, right? Mm-hmm. So like everything keeps on trying to just use in it.
The first thing I do whenever I get anytime I've got a new Samsung device is I make a folder, and it's just called Z bloatware. It starts with Z, so it goes to the end of the list of my folders, uh-huh. And then I just put literally every pre-installed app goes in there, and I've never opened that folder again.
Yeah, so I've definitely liked that a lot. Like, it feels a lot better being in the – because I am very deep in the Google ecosystem because, of course, our work email is through Google – what do they call it these days? Google Business or Apps for Your – they used to call it Google Apps for Your Domain, and they were like, maybe this is unwieldy.
I don't really know what it's – G Suite.
Yeah. So now it's called G Suite. So we got that. Of course, I use Google to log into basically everything. And I'm just like so deeply enmeshed in that thing anyway that having a phone that is also enmeshed in that actually feels pretty good. Right. So I do like that piece. But it was the case. I got home and I was putting it together and I was like – I was still having a little bit of that regret of like
– because there's no games to put on.
There's no games to put on there, you know. But then I opened up the App Store. Or the Play Store. Trademark infringement.
Did you get their subscription?
And because I was looking at what was in there, and there's actually a lot of really top end games in there right now. Yeah. Like Terraria's in there, mm-hmm. and I was the one, because it was like the first one on the list. But there's a whole bunch in there that were also Stardew Valley, right?
Yeah.
So I'm really curious if I would like to talk to some devs who are in there with titles that have done well or done, you know, okay anyway as premium titles on mobile. To find out
how that's
going, mm-hmm. right? Because our biggest worry with that service was that unlike Apple, they're not offsetting anyone's risk to going in there, as far as we know, right? Of giving you money up front to be like, hey, we know like by putting a subscription service, you might just actually make less money because now you're gonna be competing with your own product.
All we know is there's an undisclosed algorithm.
Yeah,
so it's like,
yeah,
hey, so put your game in here and hopefully that works out
right.
for you.
And these things always come with some sort of a contract of a required term where, you know, it's like a, you know, 6 months or a year or 2 years or whatever. And so that means that if you're going to go into this thing, like you have to be confident that you're not going to hamstring yourself in some way. And so I'm just really curious. I'm going to look through the list at some point of the games that are in there and see if there's any devs we know who we can reach out to and just ask. How's this going? You know, because
if any devs listening, if you got your game in the what's it called?
Google subscription. I don't know what it's called.
The Google Play.
I think it's called Play something. I don't know. The
subscription.
I can't remember.
Well, if you got something in there, send us an email. We'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, they have a like Apple does a really good job of just taking the one word that means the right thing and then just being like, this is ours now, right? Mm-hmm. So they're just like Apple Arcade, like. Now you'd say the arcade and like that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Or play the games. App Store, right? Like that's right. It's just theirs. And then Google always they're always like second to the plate. And so they have to come up with just something else. And they have
it's
to
called Google Play. We have a fitness app. Do you play
fitness?
No, you don't play it, but it's on Google Play. I don't know. Deal with it. What about movies? That's on Google Play too.
Yeah. But I'm really curious if since Google has that offering, if it actually is valuable to people, mm-hmm. if devs are going to start putting stuff in there. Because the interesting thing about that is that unlike Apple Arcade, there's no barrier. Because on the one hand, it's hard to know what the incentive is if you might just be, again, competing against your own titles inside the broader App Store, right? The broader Google Play Store. But on the other hand, if it actually does well and there's no barrier to entry.
Didn't they invite you to come in? You can't just put
I think you're invited. Actually, that's true. Yeah, you are.
It's got to be some.
It's curated.
Yeah. Otherwise, it'll just turn into
the App Store.
The Google Play Store again.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Interesting. Well, we'll kind of see. We'll get some more perspective on all this stuff over the next week. And then, Sam, you've been poking around with some vector graphics programs. I want to hear some vector graphic program reviews.
Yeah, these are just real quick. So I've been messing around with as everyone knows, we use Inkscape for production of the actual art assets for something like Levelhead, actually for all of our games the past 7 years. And I've been poking around with two other ones. So one is Affinity Designer, and there's other little one you might have heard of called Illustrator. Super like weird.
Is that it's made off by some company called Adobe?
I think it's Adobe. Okay. Yeah, they're new.
Some new upstart. Work on it.
So as part of just sort of this exploratory phase, just trying to figure out as I was working on Inkscape, the new versions of Inkscape have not actually improved my ability to do work, basically. So I'm still on 0.482.
They're up to 0.9.
They're 0.9. They're about to launch the 1.0. Mm-hmm.
They keep removing your headphone jacks.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, more so, there's just enough things in it that are like broke that I can never actually jump. And so I've been poking around to see if there's another program that would just make sense that has some more tooling in it. And so Affinity Designer has been interesting. There's a, like a 10-day free trial people can use if you're interested in that sort of thing. And the an Illustrator then is again, like sort of super powerhousey, but also it's kind of like all the other Adobe products where you have to always use menus to do things that you should just be able to fucking do, right? And so, for example, if you want to flip something in Illustrator, in Inkscape, I just hit a button and I flip, it flips. Like, you know,
H, horizontal H, flip.
Done. And then in Illustrator, you have to open a, you have to click a tool and then click the thing and open a sub menu and then decide which one you're doing and then hit OK.
And they, you got to input your two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
They must have, like, did you check for their keyboard shortcut
so
stuff?
Here's the problem. So they do have keyboard shortcuts, but not for everything. So they don't surface most things, actually.
And do they have customizable ones, though?
They are customizable, except you can't use Alt or Control when you're putting in your keyboard shortcuts for some fucking reason that I cannot figure out. And also, apparently, no one on the forums can figure out. Everyone's like, well, why? But then they have this really cool system called Actions, right, where you can build basically macro. So you can record yourself doing something, like, for example, flipping an object, and then you can assign it to a key. But you can only assign it to the F1 through F12 keys.
So you can have up to 12 macros that are really –
that are up there. Yeah, I was like, what are you guys doing?
But the F12, he uses F12.
Yeah, but the tooling is neat. And there's a bunch of, like, they, so part of it is learning how each one of these programs handles basically this, the simple act of like adding two shapes together, right? In vector, which is like if you have a square and you put a triangle on top of it, you just add them together. And now you got like a weird sort of rock shape, right? You got a trayer. And each of them actually handles these things very, all three of the programs handle them differently. Inkscape, you're just like, boom, and it's done. And that's it. And that's your life now. In something like Affinity Designer, you can put the shapes together and add them together, but it's actually non-destructive, like non-destructive 3D modeling. And so basically what that means is that both paths are still present. And so you can then go in if you want and like move the square a little bit, but there's still one shape. It's weird. And then in Photoshop, there's this thing called the like manage shapes tool. So you actually can't basically doing all that adding and subtracting stuff. Again, there's a sub menu for it that you have to click on that there's no hotkeys for. Or you have to build actions and put them on F1 through fucking 4 or whatever. But in you can like it's just this weird thing where you basically you like hold a button and then you kind of draw through the shape to tell it which pieces to add together. I don't know. It's the thing, like all the workflows are just a little bit different. And it was just sort of it was just reminding me that, you know, in the building of any one of these tools, there are literally just thousands of decisions to make about how to do any one thing. Yeah. Right? And so what you come up against when you're switching tools or when you're coming into it for the first time is learning how this particular team decided to implement thousands of little tiny things that the sum of them might just be really, really annoying in some particular ways, right? And I think that was my original feeling.
And also depending on the kind of work that you're doing specifically, right?
Yes, and that's mainly what it is. It's like the stuff I do is not the usual use case for something like Illustrator. Or even something like Inkscape. And so I've always just been sort of like, it's a square peg in a round hole, but you can't add them together sort of a situation. You know what I mean? And so that's been what I've been feeling around.
Yeah.
So are you still just Inkscaping it up, you think?
I don't know. I'm going to keep on poking around Illustrator for another week or two. But
get your clicking finger warmed up.
It's the thing is like, there's missing features in every single one of these programs, or they handle some thing that I have to do a lot in a very annoying way. And so it's like, can you?
Yeah. So this is something that, so I just finished my two GDC talks, and one of them was about DevOps. And a big part of DevOps is learning about how waste is created in your workflow, and also the effects that waste has. And so one of the most interesting sort of like stories from our past was, Sam, when we heat mapped your cursor in Inkscape to see where your mouse was going, and we discovered that like half of your mouse movements were going to menus and stuff.
Or to tools.
To click on things. And so we got hotkeys for all those things. And so then your mouse never has to leave the art. And then even though half of your time was going into menus, your production speed tripled.
Right.
And it's because having to constantly leave the thing you're doing and go to a menu is actually a lot more expensive than just the time.
Correct.
Because
it's mentally taxing.
It's mentally taxing to task switch. And so it may be the case that even though, like, on paper, you might have like a quote speedier process because maybe like Illustrator has this cool tool that you can use or whatever. to do something that would take you a little bit more work in Inkscape. But if the whole workflow is filled with all of these annoyances.
So this is, yeah, this is kind of where I'm arriving, where it's like there's things that I literally cannot do in something like Inkscape that Illustrator can do easily. But as far as that, like the moment to moment grind of like 90% of the work of just building an image,
it still
feels like it's actually going to be more taxing. So I've been like half my work has been, I'll draw some stuff for a while and then I'll be like, why the hell is that like that? I'm going to go Google around on Illustrator forums to figure out like how people fixed it. It's even stuff like if you're using a selection tool, the selection, you draw a marquee, you draw a box, right? And usually it's, you select everything that's inside of the box completely gets selected. For some reason, Illustrator's like, anything that touches this box is now selected. And you can't turn that off. So great. So now anytime I touch my mouse fucking anywhere, like I just grab everything on the screen and then like I'm doing it. And so it's stuff like that where I'm like, and I can't get in there. Like you can't fiddle with it.
Do they have the little lasso selector that does the same thing? Because it's like, I don't remember from my Photoshop. Was it Photoshop days, which is literally back in old Photoshop, 20 years ago or whatever?
I don't know if they had
that. That was 20 years ago.
I'll go poke around.
It was because the idea with all their selections is that they'll select whatever they touch, right?
Yeah.
But so they have that little lasso tool. You don't actually have to lasso stuff with it. You can just touch stuff with the line and then it'll become selected. So you can use that to select whatever you want and only whatever you want instead of trying to box it.
Yeah. So this thing is like I got to figure out all these workarounds to like be able to have the workflow I want because it's not actually a natural workflow in that program.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, there's that whenever you're picking up a new tool, so whether it's a new programming language or a new art tool or whatever, you have to strike this really weird balance that's really uncomfortable of trying to learn the tool for what it is and using it the way it was designed, right? While also taking the way that you know how to do things and like jamming it in there, right? And what I've seen from people in programming languages of moving from one to another is that they almost always have a bad time because they're trying to make the other language just be exactly the language they came from. And it just isn't.
Yeah. You need to be like water.
Yeah, you have to change everything you're doing to fit that, right?
Right.
But you can't always do that depending on what you're trying to do. Or even if when you can, that might just make it so that your primary work is a big pain in the ass, right?
So it's basically what I'm trying to figure out. I need to get to that point where I'm familiar enough with it that I can see how it's trying to make me work and then figure out if I can work in there or not.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at.
It's tricky. Man. Interesting. All right. Well, I think we're going to get on to some questions. So we're going to try to make a better effort to get questions earlier into the podcast because we always yammer too much.
Yeah, which is important because we had, I think, three more things on the list of non-questions to talk about.
We had to skip them.
Well,
I'll just say we had to talk about Fortnite being dead, but we're not going to talk about that.
Nope.
It's dead, though.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe it won't be dead by next episode, and then maybe we'll talk about that. All right. Well, the highest voted question from podcast.beastgosh.net comes from Retro Banana Man NL. How is Metaphorgasm doing, Sam? Selling well?
Very funny.
Or did you manage to get it off the internet?
No. So for tax purposes, I finally spent I think it took me like 2 hours one Saturday to actually make it so it's not like some weird illegal money thing happening to me.
Cool.
Got that. And then I had the option.
It's a lot of money coming from that.
So many. And then I think because – so I talked to some people at the Shenanicon about it because, of course, a few people brought the book to
me. Oh, did some people? I didn't see it. Nice.
Which
did you sign it?
I did. Unfortunately. But I think to me it's become like such a funny community in-joke that I was like, it's fine.
Just keep it.
It's a community in-joke that you get like a few dollars off of every now and then.
Yeah, literally. So I mean, you don't make money off it. It's just like a thing.
You might get – maybe like twice a year you can buy yourself a sandwich off of it.
Get that poetry money. Watch out.
So I think it's – Metaphorgasm is just going to stay there.
It'll be there.
For those who want to seek it out, it's there at the top of the mountain. All right. Next question comes from Chalosis. Can you all break down your current project management workflow, including how Crashlands tasks are tracked, if there still are any? Do you use the same systems for home life?
The second answer for me is very easy, which is just no.
Yeah, definitely not. There's not nearly as much to manage. To
wrangle.
It's because there's only two people at home.
Yeah.
And we're doing mostly the same stuff.
And also, I'm just not on top of stuff at home.
Well, that's
the main thing.
Honestly, when we started doing our DevOps stuff, I did set up a Trello board for my home things.
I also did, and I never used
it. Yeah, and we actually did use it for a couple of weeks, and we got so much shit done. Like, the house was just under control, and then we got busy with non-house stuff, and we just kind of stopped doing that, and then everything just kind of got 2019'd.
Well, there's this funny thing that happens, though, which is that a lot of things you don't have to do, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you could think of things to do that you, like, oh, I need to get this done. And the reality is, if you don't do it, there's oftentimes, for a lot of things, it's fine if you don't do it or you don't do it for a while. And so I think with regards to home stuff, a lot of it is more in that category.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it is recurring things that happen, like, every month you got to do this thing, in which case having, like, a production meeting thing is weird. Instead, you need something that, like, has recurring reminders or whatever.
But it's true. Almost everything at home falls in the non-urgent, non-important category.
Until you got water coming through your roof.
Yeah, or important and non-urgent.
Which or is, important and non-urgent.
Yeah,
so it's all in the non-urgent.
So I actually use Todoist for managing all of my non-work stuff. Because you can put recurring reminders on there. You can categorize stuff into groups. And you can also share things. So Sampada has her Todoist. I have mine. And then we have a shared set of lists that are like house-related things and stuff.
Yeah, we use Google Keep for shared things.
Google
Keep. Which is mostly for just shared grocery lists and that sort of thing.
I see.
Yeah.
So the workflow in the studio is a bit more involved.
Only a little bit, though. So because we have a Trello board. Everyone's on Trello boards. And then
it's like a hybrid of per project / per person, sort of.
Yes, because we found that people tend to only look at one board, Adam.
Well, people can only really do one thing. People can focus on one thing primarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
you got to respect that.
Yeah.
So it depends how much stuff is on the board. So we have a studio operations board. Which is then kind of like mostly what Sampada takes care of, but there's a lot of stuff that other people take care of. Mm-hmm. But because when it comes to other people taking care of stuff on that list, I'm the lowest on that in terms of the number of things that I have to do. That also means the less you interact with the thing, the less you care and the less you check it, right? And we found that this was a general phenomenon that we used to have a lot more boards. Mm-hmm. And we've over time consolidated them down to the sort of like project / person specific thing and even things that it's like I have a web dev board, but even things that aren't really web dev, if somebody knows I need to do it, it goes into that inbox because right. that's the one I'm paying attention to that I factor into my time spend for our 16-hour sprints and all that mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah. So the way it works then is that over the course of any given sprint, everyone's dumping cards into the inbox. So you might say, oh, I had this idea for this thing, or oh, we need to fix this, or I found this bug, whatever. You just throw it in the inbox. Don't talk to anybody about it.
Don't bother anybody about it.
Whatever, because we got 16 hours for the next one. At the conclusion,
that's that part of that value of that short sprint.
Yes, because you can check on
because
work.
Almost anything can wait for 2 days.
Yes, and so we then check in during the production meeting. So production meetings are run in board order. So we go studio operations first. Basically, the idea is to go through the boards on Trello in the same order that work tends to get produced downstream. So first, start with operations because some of the decisions and operations cascade into the other categories of work and then create cards or move work into those categories.
Yeah, a lot of it for us is because we have that split work where we're making the product, but we're also managing the company. And so
we have extra complications there.
Yeah. And so a lot of it is making sure that we know how to allocate time. Right. Yes. And so we move in sort of the direction in which things, in which time gets allocated and can be freed up or not and so on.
Yep. And so it goes studio board and then portfolio maintenance stuff. So it's basically Crashlands / everything else as well
sure
as
stuff.
Yeah, all of the platform specific things. And then into Levelhead / web dev. So like basically web dev as it relates to Levelhead stuff and then Levelhead. So the reason that order of ops is that way is so that people can leave the meeting as soon as possible. So basically, sampling is done after the first board.
So we start the production meeting with everybody in the studio, and then people just leave as their stuff is assigned and taken care of.
And you just count up how many hours you have available, given other meetings and things you may have planned or other things going on.
Yeah, so you check the calendar, check all your cards.
Okay, I have 14 hours available. We're going to put in then like 11 hours of actual slotted work for you to do, so you have some slack time. And then you pick those like couple of tasks, and that's it. So then for the next 2 days or a couple of days – you just go to your Trello boards. You know exactly what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. And then we make sure that – so then we have on the board, we then have the doing pile, which is where that stuff goes. And so the session basically looks like we look at the done or needs review or whatever categories and clear those out. So that's just out of the way. And then we go to the inbox to find out what needs to happen with that. Mm-hmm. And so we take every item in the inbox and either move it into to do if it doesn't need to happen now or into doing if it really needs to happen in the sprint.
Or if it turns out to not be important, we just delete it.
Yep. Or just delete it. Yep. And
the best way to get work done is to not do it at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we make sure that basically the top of your to-do list is stuff that if you ended up clearing your doing pile, then if you could just go pull stuff kind of willy-nilly out of the top of your to-do list, or your to-do stack, then you would still be accomplishing important, mm-hmm. useful stuff.
Yep. So, and I think as far as like the software dev side goes, there's one extra part of the Trello board, which we added more recently, which is, so it goes inbox, to do, doing, then testing, then yeah. done, mm-hmm. right? So it's essentially using the Trello board to represent the required steps for a piece of work to go through, right. and we have to treat it as mandatory. And so before we had the testing step that was like a manual required double check for everything that you did, so we had so many things falling through the cracks. Oh, yeah. And so now something isn't done until you've run it through whatever the testing procedure is for mm-hmm. that thing, which is really nice.
And the testing, when it gets converted, it's either testing or waiting, depending on the style of board. It's like the studio ops board, like we're not testing.
You're not testing an email.
Test anything in there, but you might be waiting. So yeah. instead of leaving that in your doing pile, like where it's kind of clogging stuff up, you just say, oh yeah, I emailed this person, I'm waiting on it. So that goes in here now. And then you wait there until it's done.
Yep. Yep. So yeah, but I mean, it's the most important thing is just to like step back, recognize how work needs to move through mm-hmm. the organization, and then set up your structure to make that. Sure that that happens. And also to try to make it so that work doesn't go backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right? The key thing.
Like if you move
and
something –
you're not doing unplanned work. It's those, yeah. those are the two keys to the
– Yeah. So if you're moving things from your inbox into your doing pile outside of a production meeting, that's a problem because now you're just like – now you're just doing things randomly.
Yeah. Well, it's also that's basically the definition of unplanned work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody agreed on what was going to happen, and then
and
you're
then
like,
you did something else
and you're
instead.
Like, no, I mean, just grab shit out the inbox yep, and just do it. So if those things are happening a lot, then you've got a structural problem.
And you can even do this just if you're doing solo work, you can do this with yourself, right? Because you can have the same setup, and then yeah. for yourself, your production meeting is basically you sitting down with your board and then going over it yourself, right?
Just do like a twice weekly check in.
I mean, you can even do it every morning, right? Because there's no meeting
discussion.
Overhead. There's yeah. no discussion has to happen. And honestly, I think you should do it every morning if you're a solo dev, and that'll basically throughout your day as emails are coming in, like things are happening, you just take all those things that are being generated, put it in your inbox, and don't worry about it. And then
just
tomorrow morning,
wait the next day.
Next day, like go through your inbox, finish out your plans, and you know.
Yeah, the general point here is, and this is really true for it's for anybody who wants to be productive. It's like one of the best things you can do, the highest leverage thing you can do at all to just sort of get going is just to plan your day. Literally, like if you take 10 minutes at the beginning of your day to be like, what am I doing today and what's important, you just will have way better days. And so it's the same sort of idea in an organization, right, with the production
yeah.
meetings.
Yeah, yep. and in the
it's
organization –
slightly more complicated.
Yeah, in the organization, you call it a cadence, a yeah. work cadence, which is like the rhythm by which work gets planned and executed. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have any kind of routines built around – the planning and the execution of things, then you have to be remaking decisions all the time yeah. about when you're going to be making other decisions, and then you're just tired.
Yeah. And I've actually found – so I've been doing – I've started my second – or I guess my third art class online. And I noticed this with how I've been doing my scheduling for the art class. Previously, I would just be like sort of mentally be like, all right, the afternoon on Saturday, I'm just going to be doing all this art stuff. And recently I've been using this thing called Focus Mate, which I found through that Indistractable book, where basically you just sign up for a time slot and then you have to meet someone online with your webcam at that time slot to do your work. And it's just enough social pressure where you will actually show up. At least yeah. it's working very well for me.
And legit, all you do is you just come in and you go, what are you working on? And they're like, I don't know, I'm studying for the SATs or something. Mm-hmm. What are you working on? And you're like, I'm doing art for the next yep. hour. And then they're like, everybody's like, all right.
And then you mute and then you just hang out.
And then you could just see each other working and yep. that's all you've got,
yeah.
you know?
But so the difference then for me this time has been I remember my mental state. The previous one was I was always worried about when I was going to get the time fitted in because I didn't actually – I might plan a time, but I didn't need to stick to it because who cares?
Because if you didn't show up
– fine.
You're not standing anybody up.
Yeah, but with this thing, I basically just slot out somewhere between 7 and 12 hours a week then of time that I'm going to be working on art. And then I just show up. I have to show up at those times now. So I've been doing one every morning before work, and then I've got three tonight and then two tomorrow night. And so it's like I just know exactly when it's happening and I will be there because I don't want to let rando on the internet down.
No.
You know? Yep. Which is really just me. You know what I mean?
Isn't it funny
we're
how –
we're all just a rando on the internet.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how badly people generally treat randos on the internet, but then for some reason when you're going to have like a webcam session with a rando on the internet, you're like, I can't –
I gotta be there.
I've literally never met this person. I'm never gonna see them again, but I have to be.
I don't want to let them down.
Yeah. Don't want to make this person disappointed.
Yep.
Our next question comes from Wiggly Honk Quick Pie.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Who says, what are your plans for solving the new player experience problem once you guys launch 1.0, especially in the community generated content area? Thanks. All right, I will say we've given up.
Yeah, more or less.
So the campaign with its unlocks was our original idea of the new player experience, because we said, like, people are – they have no idea what they're looking at. Everything in this game is new, and it has analogies. It's got similarities to other things, but it's all new. And so what we found was that people just hated that because they felt like they now had to play the campaign, the whole thing, and 100% it before they could ever do anything
else. Which was true in the sense of you couldn't get access to certain things until you beat
– Yeah, like you couldn't build like a level with spike traps until you're halfway through the campaign or whatever. So if you're saying to yourself, like, literally the only level I can imagine building is one with spike traps, then yes, that's definitely true that you got to get there first. So what we found was then people would come into the game. They would play the campaign for like 12 hours first. And if they survived that phase, then they would start to engage with the community, right? And so we found that once we removed all those campaign locks, then people would come into the game and they would –
much more fluid.
Yeah, they play the campaign a little bit and they'd be like, ooh, I'm going to go see what else is going on. And then they'd go start building levels and then they'd be like, I'm confused. And then they go play some other people's levels. And so the campaign is basically there as like a safety net.
It should give you something that's always fun to do, basically.
Yeah, with a reasonable sense of progression and that you can opt into.
Yeah, the reality is that we can't – there's no way that we can control someone's first – it's like if you try to control sometimes a first experience on the internet or on Twitter or something.
Yeah, what happens when somebody opens up Google Chrome? Like, how do you how do you control it?
Yeah, they're going to go somewhere.
What are they going to do?
What are they going to do? And it might be like a good thing, might be a bad thing. And so I think that's a big part of it is that, you know, on any given day, there's incredible stuff at the top of the marketing department. But I think for the most part, the question is just how hard is it really? But that's not really something we can control. Well, so,
and I'm less worried about it for the new player experience at the outset, because what you can see, there's an interesting trend, which is like when we first launched into early access, the levels that were made at that time, a lot of them were like 5-star max difficulty levels. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, if you go back and play those levels as a player who's been playing for several months, you'd be like, this is trivial. Right. This is super easy, right? Mm-hmm. Because the community will, on average, make levels that are based around the average skill level of the community.
Right. Or probably a little harder than the average skill
of the community. And so if you end up with a huge influx of players around launch, then you got a whole bunch of bad players who don't know what they're doing making content, which means the levels are generally going to be a lot easier kind of at that outset. They're not going to be built around bugs and gimmicks and tricks. Right. That comes the next week.
Yeah.
And that's when everything flies off the rails.
Yes. I think it'll be – fine. We're reevaluating some aspects of the campaign already. Just like I swept through and added armor to a bunch of things. Basically, I made the campaign I'm trying to make it just more enjoyable, just like a way more enjoyable experience throughout.
Yeah. And it is the case that our goal leading up to the full launch is actually to put a lot of focus on the campaign. Yeah. And that's a big part of why. So we've updated our patch schedule to now be much more spread out because those campaign changes are just very heavy. Yeah. We need to make more.
For example, if you're like, oh, we want to add armor into the campaign more, it's like, okay, let's go update 30 levels. Yeah. You know? And then while I'm in there, I'm like, oh, this is actually a terrible thing. And then I go,
it's just like refactoring code.
It's refactoring
code. You're going to refactor it while you're in there. So you're now going to spend half an hour per level instead of just 5 minutes. Then you have to beat each one to actually get it republishable to make sure it's basically tested, you know?
Yep. And we also would like to add more unlockable avatars into the campaign. So like you achieve certain things, you get a cool – like you beat some really hard level and got the GR-17 and it's like a Lazumi level or something. And get a cool Lazumi avatar.
Yeah. So as far as like new player experience stuff goes, it's always a mix to me because there's games – I mean I think a lot of the experience on mobile is so handheld or locked where you can't – they won't let you touch anything except for the thing that they're trying to
touch. They do that bullshit where they darken the whole screen.
Except for like a little
zone. And then they glow the button and they put like an arrow.
And they're like, buy this guy. And I'm like, I don't want this one. I want the other one.
But we need to show you how our currency works.
Yeah. And so
– you can buy
it. That's like that degree. And then you have stuff like Minecraft, right? Where you're just like, I'm a block person now and I need to make N-shaped pants. And that's my life. I got to use the wiki to figure everything out.
So we kind of landed somewhere in the middle.
I think being in the middle is the best place to be where there's just enough to get going.
Which is for us, it's you run through the first two levels of the campaign, which shows you have to deliver the package. Mm-hmm. And here's the grappling hook, basically.
And then whatever.
Then that's your problem now.
Because I think what you want to do is set the person up such that they like the content and they're excited about it enough that if they run into any hitches, that they're more likely to either just keep on coming back or to go search out answers for those things, like online somewhere.
Yeah, I think the one thing we'll want to really consider with all this is how do we train people to understand how to find decent content in the player-made content. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the trick, is that a lot of people are going to have that experience where the first thing they'll do, because we don't actually guide what the first thing they do is to interact with the community, right? So the first thing they do may be to go in the marketing department. And if they're in there, that's a very different experience than going into the tower, right? In terms of what you can actually do, like what it means for that content to be in there. And so if a person publishes a level before they go to the marketing department, then that actually is kind of connected and makes sense, because now they saw their level go in there. We tell them stuff about that. But if they just want to go right into player made content at the moment, there's no way for you to know, oh, I know what a marketing department is. I know what the tower is. Yeah. And even when you're in there, understanding what it is you're looking at and why it is that way.
Yeah. I mean, you have to go explore currently.
You have to go explore. So I think that might be the one place, especially the marketing department, because the tower is kind of self-explanatory because it's a browser and you have all these sorting options and stuff. But the marketing department maybe less, you know, I don't know.
It's always mixed on these things, because so I started playing Dwida, the pixel wizard game, where basically every pixel is simulated and you run around, you got a wand, and you're like, it's basically like a run and gunner sort of thing, but you have a wand. And so naturally there's different spells that come out the end of it, sort of the idea. I started playing that last week, and I've only played it just a little bit, probably 2 hours or so. And they do not tell you anything about anything. Uh-huh. And the weird thing is, it's fine.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, like, the basics of it are compelling enough that you're running around and you're just slowly kind of picking up, because you can still play it without knowing anything.
Yeah. That's sort of the point. I think that's super fun, though, because it's you get in there and you're just like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Like, what am I?
Yeah.
And of course, with Levelhead, we actually kind of realized that we wanted the workshop to be like, if you're a kid and you go to a friend's house and they're like, check out my toy box.
Yeah.
And you pop that shit open, you're like, what is all of this? Mm-hmm. I've never seen half of these things, right? And so we wanted it to be the case that, yeah, you're going to see familiar stuff. You're going to see spikes, you know, and things where you're like, oh, yeah, I get that. And then you're going to see like a key switch. And you're like, the fuck do use this for?
Yeah, and from watching people who are doing their first builds, because we watched a few streamers work on this, and people do exactly what I would imagine they do in a situation where there's just too many things, which is they just pick like two or three things. Mm-hmm. And that's literally what they're building a level out of. Because at any given point, like, you don't have – the reason the campaign exists is to make it so you have the mental bandwidth at the time just by playing to experience all these different things and get an idea of what's going on. You cannot do that from inside the editor. Like, yeah. People don't do that. Literally, they open it up. They put down like a barrel, and now they're making a level entirely about barrels. They just ignore –
I guess our main approach then for the new player experience is to force them to play like two or three campaign levels. Yep.
Just so they know how to move.
Just so they know, just so they can move around and they've seen decent level design and that sort of thing, right? And then after that, we just say,
all right, it's up to you now.
It's all
on the campaign is here if you need it, but otherwise, go crazy.
Yep.
So I think that's the right move. And then the campaign will basically serve to fill out some more lore, because we're going to be working on some extra little cutscenes and stuff. And then have cool little extra cosmetic flair that you can get access to by just being good. So, all right. Next question comes from Mopate Flatunk, who says, you guys are avid learners and seem to always be trying to ingest information. How do you decide what to learn next? Is it a conscious decision, or do you just let the universe decide?
Mm.
It usually kind of comes out of necessity. In a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think for me anyway, I'm always trying to keep in touch with what's for web dev, kind of what's hot, what people are paying attention to. And you got to be really careful with web dev in particular, because there's always some new hot thing this week, and that's going to be gone next week. And so you want to wait until something has settled a bit, you know, and gotten good in terms of having good tooling and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Full community around it.
Yeah, full community and all that. And so I'm kind of just always on the lookout. So I have like my Feedly, where I have all my RSS feeds of stuff that I read, includes things from like CSS tricks and from just like various tech blogs from people and stuff. And I listen to podcasts. So I listen to a podcast called Syntax.fm, which is all about web development. And so that I'm just like hearing about all the stuff, right?
Right.
So that I can every once in a while be like, oh, that seems like something I should actually like learn about, because it could be really useful, or just everyone's talking about this and it seems like
it's come up enough.
Yeah, it's come up. Yeah. So then recently that was like, so a few months ago, then that was like, that for me, that was TypeScript, which is, I'd been hearing about it constantly for frankly a long time. And I was like, maybe I should actually investigate what it would mean to, you know, build this into my systems. And so I spent some time taking some courses and practicing with it. And then discovered that it is very powerful, and now that's part of my core tool set. Mm. And then similarly, just been hearing about GraphQL constantly for months. But this is a brand new weird thing. And I didn't even know what it was. I had no idea what it meant. And so that was one of those things. At some point, I was just like, I've been hearing about this enough. I need to go fucking learn what this is.
Right.
And so I can't use it because I haven't learned enough and I haven't played with it. But now I know what it is, right? I learned enough that I have just a general sense of what's going on out there, and feel like if I needed to go add something to my toolkit. And for me, it's mostly being aware of what is possible, so that when I'm confronting a problem, I'm aware of like, oh yeah, okay, this problem – my current tool set would be fine, but now I know about this thing called GraphQL, right, for example, right, that if I were to go learn that and solve it using this, would probably make my life a lot better.
You don't have to learn it. You have to learn a little bit about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think there's something to be said, I think, for the toe dip, which is something I've done a lot, which is, I mean, even back when I started working on Inkscape, the first time I did anything in Inkscape, I made just like some really simple, stupid stick figure drawings, mm-hmm. right? And that was entirely my goal, because I'd been reading the Oatmeal comics, and I was like, I can make pictures that approximate that probably. Turns out it's harder than that. But so I got in there and I started just making, it was for free illustration software, and I made some stick figures, and then I just didn't do anything with it for like 6 months. And then Seth and I started making games, and I made some art form in that because I'd also been using it to make like little tiny web icons for some web dev stuff I was doing. But there was never a concerted effort to like learn Inkscape. It was sort of until we were basically doing the studio full time. So what I've noticed in terms of my pattern is I basically dip a toe sort of just repeatedly into something, or I'll go, I even picked up Blender a few weeks ago and did like 3 hours of tutorials in it. That's probably the third time I've done that, right? Picked up Unreal a few months ago and did like the little pinball tutorial where you learn how to make a little maze game. And just sort of picking up and putting down all these little things just so you know what is out there and what could possibly be useful. So I always have just a big list of stuff that... So I don't use like Todoist or anything. I don't have actually like a to-do list. I just have my workflow, which literally now is just an inbox. It's just an inbox and then an archive is sort of the two modes. Hmm. And the inbox just has this, it's just an ever-growing list of stuff that I was like, this might be interesting to look at.
Like if you hear about an interesting book about something you don't know about.
Exactly.
Like, I'm gonna throw that on my list. And then next time you're looking for something to do, you just dip into that
one. Speaking of books, like one of the best ways to do it is to sort of rabbit hole through books. So if you're reading a book and it's good and the author mentions another book, go get that book next, right? And so you'll end up just in weird places. So I just finished a book called Hope in the Dark, which is about like activism and stuff and about the concept of hope. I would never have just picked that off a shelf, but it was around, And so I ended up reading it.
It's about exposing your mind to sources of information that open up new sources of information.
Yes.
So like I liked to listen to the Ezra Klein podcast. Mm-hmm. He just finds usually authors or activists or just people with like interesting scientific backgrounds or whatever, usually who have written a book. And then he'll interview them about their work and about what they've been doing. And so not only do you get the book recommendation just based off of that person, if you're like, oh, I like what this person's talking about, it sounds interesting, you can now go read their book. But then also he always ends the podcast episode with asking them for their three book recommendations that they think everybody should read.
Mm.
So you actually get like four book recommendations from every episode of this podcast. And so I've read tons of books just off of that alone. Mm-hmm. And usually, like you said, it's about things that I would totally not have sought out or heard of.
Yeah.
Like my favorite one is the book How to Do Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Just such a weird book. You know, like it talks about like hippie communes and about art. And
it's a very academic book.
It's really deep.
You told me to read it. I was like, okay, yeah, sounds fine. I'll check it out. But so I think a lot of it is just sort of being willing to check out things that you know nothing about. Like that's mainly it, right? And also
or even in some cases, things where you would maybe be dismissive of it, you know, outright. Because like I've told a number of people who know me very well that, hey, I haven't eaten meat in the last 10 days or whatever. And they're like, what? That I would not have expected that in a million years.
Right.
I never had a particular strong opinion about meat. It just tasted good and it was a good source of protein.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can just meet those two criteria in another way, then it's fine. And if I sort of am willing to break the routine and break the habit and just like try some stuff, then you can find all kinds of interesting stuff out there.
Yeah, I think the reality is if you can set aside, you know, an hour a day or even just a couple hours in a given week where it's just learning time, like that's just the best, honestly. And you just have a list of things you've been kind of keeping an eye on, maybe articles you want to read or books you want to check out, and then just go dive into them. And then don't worry about, like, you don't, I guess, I always used to think that you had to get all the way in if you were going to go do something. And I'm like, I just don't care anymore.
Yeah. And I think using something like Feedly with sources that kind of like, that kind of, so whatever it is you're into. So if you're into game dev, then you can add, you have some, having an aggregate feed reader, right? That you can get game, whatever, Gama Sutra and like a handful of other sort of like game design focused places that you just have that have like the top things just come arrive on your device. And you can just flip through it and be like, oh, is this, does this seem like something that I could learn something from, right? And if you do that with whatever it is you're into, so again, if it's web dev, there's a whole bunch of resources for that too. Because you will be just confronted constantly with things you've never heard of or seen. And then you can always, at every time you see that, you should just go one layer deep, just like follow the link, you know, and like anytime you see a word you don't know, follow that link, try to figure out what that is. I'm doing this right now with Unity, so I can try to get a sense of like what the Unity ecosystem looks like. And my approach to these kinds of things, like if I want to like really learn a thing, I'm literally reading the documentation right now.
Right.
Because I opened up Unity and I was starting to take a tutorial and it's sort of like opening up Illustrator or anything else, right? Yeah,
there's
a million menu items. There's a million damn menu items.
Basically, you need a campaign to play through.
Yeah.
You do, yeah.
Instead of.
But I was like, even, and they were like talking through the things and they'd be like, oh yeah, so you can, you know, you can make this kind of an asset and like it pops up on the screen and then its thing pops out and then it has, and then there's even like a little filter view thing and you open it up and there's literally 50 things in this checklist of things you can uncheck. And I don't even know how to convert any of those words into something that makes sense in my brain. I don't know what any of it is, right? And so I was like taking this tutorial and like this guy was like doing this high level stuff. And I was like, this is actually, I know too little about this. I know too little about 3D game engines for a high level like tutorial to leave me feeling anything but dissatisfied, you know?
It's interesting because
so I'm literally reading the documentation.
Yeah, it's interesting that's your approach because mine's always, I just do a few of the high-level things first.
It depends on the thing.
I usually get like a very broad,
if it's view. Something that I feel like I already have some knowledge in, then even if there's a lot of like unknowns and questions, I'm completely content with like the first high-level thing, right? So like if I'm learning a new program, like I've learned enough programming languages by now that if I wanted to go to another one, I just dive right in. Like right. There's not a problem there. And then over time, I start to accumulate actually sort of language
deeper knowledge about it.
But when it's something complete, because I honestly feel like Unity compared to everything else I know is just like, it's just a different thing. Because Unity isn't programming. It's a comprehensive suite of tools, right? That's what it is. In the same way, there's programming in there, but that's actually like almost an aside. Like if you're right. if you're doing any work at all in learning about Unity, almost everything that you're being taught in all these courses and stuff is not programming. There's almost no programming.
Like,
here's how you assemble all the kinds of components that are built into this thing.
Right. Here's what a game object is.
Yeah, it's a different thing.
You check this box and now this thing has physics.
Like, yeah.
You didn't program anything. You just checked the physics box.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's a different way of thinking. So that's different enough that I'm approaching that the same way I would approach just like learning art, for example, which is I'd be like, I'm not gonna just go start drawing. I'm gonna go take a course. I'm gonna go like get really in there because I know too little for like the really cursory stuff.
Well, you have to start with the how do I hold this fucking pencil question, right? Because I mean, I remember when I was first starting, I was like, I don't know, and no one would talk about it. I was like, I'd go dig up some YouTube videos. I just had to ask the question on YouTube because all the courses I was taking, everyone just assumed that you knew how to hold a pencil.
On that note, and related but also unrelated, if anybody listening has not ever looked up knife skills, like for cooking, you know?
I thought you meant like for fighting.
Not for fighting. Although that too. But no, for like how do you hold a chef's knife and how do you like properly use it? I 100% guarantee you were doing it wrong. It's like with a pencil. It's like I 100% guarantee you were doing it wrong.
You're supposed to hold it like the serial killer style, right?
So no, yeah.
Straight and you just down. Stab the shit. You hold it by the top and then you just stab. That's how you chop, right?
Because your fingers are actually on the blade. Like on the top of the blade as you're using it. So your hand is like really high up on the on the handle and you're actually like holding onto the blade.
So you're using it more like a chop?
Because there are a whole bunch of motions that you can do. So it's something you should, anybody who ever cooks at home ever, just look up. I think what's that? Jamie Oliver, is that the guy's name? And a few other people have really nice tutorials on like just like basic knife skills. And I think also it changes your life.
Well, it's one of those things, like just follow something that you've maybe been doing for a while and you want to do it better. I remember
you just dig in.
When I first started cooking, I was using a bunch of bell peppers. And then at one point I was like, chopping these bell peppers is taking me too fucking long.
Yeah.
There must be a better way.
There's some.
And I Googled it. And surely enough, someone was like, here's how you do it in like 4 seconds. And I was like, bah, bah, bah. And it was awesome.
But there's I think there's two parts to this. Like one is, is you need to make sure that you have the – that you give yourself this time and space to learn new things.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes down to sort of your routines and habits. Mm-hmm. So if you've orchestrated your home life or your sort of like normal structure of your day such that like you get home and you're just like boom on your phone watching Netflix or whatever, and that's just kind of your mode throughout the evening, then like you're just not going to learn new stuff because you're kind of stuck there. Yeah. So your first move is to figure out how to break those patterns to create the space, and then also to make it so that your new default becomes reading books or whatever it is. And I think the other thing kind of in line with this, like how do you hold a pencil or how do you cut vegetables? Mm-hmm. Like people tend to develop this weird attitude where they're like, I fucking know. I've been doing this for 30 years. Yeah. Like I know how to hold a pencil. No, you don't. You don't. Nobody ever really taught you that thing, right? And so you have to kind of get away from your own ego.
You learned it from some rando. There's some other rando out there who's doing it better.
Yeah, there's a billion techniques.
Yeah, and so kind of just like letting go of the ego side of it and just being like, I probably don't know a damn thing about even the things I've been doing my whole life. And once you kind of get there, then you can just kind of be excited about pretty much everything that you come across because it's all new.
It's all learning.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Costa, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net. We've got links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye. Bye.